Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. Two former state prosecutors are being accused of misconduct in connection with a state drug lab scandal in Western Massachusetts. The case involves former state drug lab chemist Sonia Farrick, who stole and used the drugs she was supposed to be testing in the lab in Amherst. Yesterday, a judge threw out seven convictions connected to Farrick and found that the two prosecutors deliberately concealed documents about the extent of Farrick's drug use while on the job. We'll hear from one of the defense attorneys in a moment, but first we're joined by WBUR senior reporter David Boeri, who's been following this story. David, good to have you in here.
Thanks, Anthony.
So explain the full extent here about Sonia Farrick and what she was doing at the lab.
So she's a state chemist at the drug lab in Amherst. And during the course of some 8 years, she swallowed, snorted, siphoned, and smoked her way through a whole larder of crack, weed, LSD, ecstasy, and the rest of it. It was sort of like a Bob's Big Boy. She kept on going, piling her plate. But this is terribly serious because she stole and switched samples.
Yeah.
And there's as many as 18,000 cases that public defenders estimate could be linked to her and were all considered tainted by her certifications.
Unbelievable. So now, how did her drug use come to light?
Well, this is fascinating because she's arrested in early 2013. And in her car, the car's a mess. The police investigators searching the car, they find drugs, drug paraphernalia. They also found in the whole mess a mental health diary that she had been keeping because she was dealing with her own secret drug addiction and she was receiving treatment for it. It provided a clue that when pursued would lead back to this devastating find. But prosecutors sat on the evidence of what it was for 22 months, and they fought disclosure of that evidence even to a criminal defense attorney, Luke Ryan, and they accused him of being on a fishing expedition.
Mm. Now, to a lot of listeners, this might sound familiar to another case, so I just want to be very clear that this is separate from the Annie Duquesne scandal, the former chemist at the state lab in Jamaica Plain who falsified drug tests in order to get convictions.
Separate from it, although Farrick worked with her for a time in the Jamaica Plain lab. But it was the Duquesne scandal. It was in full mode when the arrest of Farrick took place. And it was Attorney General Martha Coakley, then the Attorney General, who had assured the public that this new scandal was a small one, unlike Duquesne. It was a scandal of just a few weeks. But the evidence I was talking about found in the car was a discovery that Farrick had been using drugs since 2004. So instead of being a four-week scandal, it was an eight-year scandal.
Wow. Wow. So tell me about the two former assistant attorneys general. They're Ann Kaczmarek and Chris Foster. What are they specifically accused of doing?
So deliberately concealing documents and making misrepresentations to the court, which is a nicer way of saying lies to the court. Chris Foster had told a judge that all the relevant materials had been turned over. She hadn't even checked the files. She was relying on what she said she'd been told from people above her. And so that's hers. And meanwhile, Kaczmarek led the prosecution of Farrick, and she knew about the worksheets. She told a state police sergeant who found the documents not to talk about them in the grand jury. And above and all that, you also have a Kaczmarek note to the state police sergeant who says, and she's dreading another scandal, please don't let this get more complicated than we thought. Here's defense attorney Jared Olenoff, who says the attorney general ensured that a scandal devolved into a travesty of justice.
To find out now, that years later, that they were hidden from me is a really low-down, dirty thing that you don't see too often in this practice. But when you do, it's harmful. It's harmful to everybody. It's harmful to the system as a whole.
David, we should point out that we did reach out to Attorney General Maura Healey's office about this. We wanted to get a comment since obviously these assistant attorneys general overseen by her office, they did not return our request for a comment. But have we heard anything from the Attorney General's office?
No. And, you know, you're wondering, because two attorney generals, their offices are involved in this. You'd like to hear from Maura Healey that, in fact, she disapproves of what happened. But their tendency was to defend. In fact, Maura Healey's assistants were defending the case last December during those hearings that Richard Carey conducted. They wanted to minimize the role of the attorney general's office and blame the two underlings, but they argued that it was too small, that their infractions weren't worth throwing everything out for.
And have we heard anything from the two assistant attorneys general, Anne Kaczmarek and Chris Foster? Have they commented on this?
Kaczmarek has denied she's claimed that the report is wrong. She is an assistant magistrate. We haven't heard from Foster yet.
All right. Well, let me bring Northampton defense attorney Luke Ryan. He played a key role in bringing this evidence to light. Luke Ryan, good to have you on Radio Boston. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So can you just sort of go back a little bit and sort of tell us how this all started? Why did you start digging into this? What were the circumstances that led to these revelations?
Sure. So at the time of Ms. Farrick's arrest, I represented a client who had a pending drug case, and we received reports that had been written by the state police and had been disclosed from the Attorney General's office indicating that, as David mentioned, they had searched Ms. Farrick's car, and in the back they found what they termed assorted lab paperwork. So I and a number of other attorneys who represented defendants sought access to this assorted lab paperwork. We tried doing it informally through requests to the Attorney General's office. When that didn't get anywhere, we filed motions. And at every corner, we were essentially told this was irrelevant evidence. We were on a fishing expedition. And a judge ultimately made a finding based on the evidence before him back in 2013 that Ms. Farrick's misconduct, while egregious, didn't begin until the summer of 2012. So one of the justifications that they cited for not letting us see the evidence was the pending criminal prosecution against Ms. Farrick. When that concluded in January of 2014, I happened to be representing another individual who was charged with a drug crime and sought access to the evidence again and said, hey, you told me last time I couldn't see it because the case against Ms. Farrick was pending. It's not pending anymore. And eventually I was able to get a court order for that allowed me to go to Boston and look at the evidence myself. And back on October 30th, 2014, I did that, and that's when I discovered the mental health worksheet that
wow.
David referred to.
Yeah. And how surprised were you by what you found from the prosecutors?
It was pretty shocking, but it wasn't like a needle in a haystack. I mean, there was some 300 pieces of paper in the car and dozens of them related to this treatment that she was getting for a drug addiction. So it was shocking because it had an immediate impact on these cases. The present one that I was representing, as well as these past ones, were relief had been denied to my clients. But it was also shocking because it seemed clear that anybody who had given a look at this evidence would have immediately seen that it was exculpatory to my clients and should have been turned over.
And Luke, you know, characterize the extent of this potential misconduct here. I mean, what does it mean in terms to a defense attorney who's trying to defend folks? I mean, how serious is this? How do you characterize what's happened here?
Well, you know, there's a constitutional obligation that all prosecutors have to, and it's kind of counterintuitive. It's an adversarial system, but the lawyers who represent the state have this obligation to turn over evidence that could actually hurt in their case, that would make it more difficult for them to achieve their objective. So it puts them in this position where they know that if they don't do it, it's unlikely that anybody's ever going to learn about it. And it's this moral hazard that exists for prosecutors who are more interested in winning a conviction than serving justice. So this case, I think, illustrates this fear that many of us in this system have as to the things that can happen where prosecutors are in possession of things that really go to the crux of a case, and we're trying to figure out the truth. We're trying to reach a just result, and we don't have all of the available information to do that.
Right. David, how frequent is there this kind of prosecutorial misconduct? I mean, do you have a sense of that? I know
misconduct is very, very hard to find. And by the way, this is why Luke Ryan is a hero for having dug up and fought for this evidence for months. Were it not for Luke Ryan, this would not have come out. He fought and fought and fought. Robert Jackson, the U.S. Attorney General, way back in 1940, commented that the prosecutor has more control over life, liberty, and reputation than any other person in America. His discretion is tremendous. Now, the thing is, you know, defense attorneys are supposed to be zealous advocates, but the calling of the prosecutor is not, as Luke pointed out, is not to win convictions, it's to do justice. A sitting judge out in the Ninth Circuit Federal Court of Appeals in San Francisco, his name is Alex Kaczynski, he writes that prosecutors and their investigators have unparalleled access to the evidence, both inculpatory and exculpatory. And while they are required to provide exculpatory evidence to the defense, it's very difficult for the defense to find out whether the prosecution is complying with this obligation. And the whole system, Anthony, requires the disclosure of exculpatory information. If it isn't done, the system of justice fails.
Luke, could this have been an honest mistake, as one of the prosecutors says?
The short answer is no. I mean, they had one of the as David said, you know, this is kind of a rare case. We obtained literally thousands of internal emails of the Attorney General's office, and this was not evidence that anybody overlooked. They had discussed this evidence on numerous occasions and how to treat it and what to do with it. And it was really the only, I mean, Sonia Farrick denied the allegations against her. She, unlike Annie Dukin, when she was confronted, she didn't confess. She lawyered up. And so this evidence of her own writing, talking about how she tried to resist using but at work but ended up failing, that was in the back of her car, what was critical evidence in the case against Ms. Farrakh, and it would have been immediately apparent, and was immediately apparent to the people who were prosecuting her and who knew about the evidence, that it had a role to play in these other matters involving drug defendants like my clients.
And, right. And Anthony, this was made worse because the Attorney General's office, there are good guys in this story, prosecutors, local prosecutors out there in Hampden County, who if they had had the information that the Attorney General had, they would have distributed to defense attorneys across the board, so people would have found out about this. But since the Attorney General's kept the local prosecutors out of the loop, they didn't know, so this didn't come forward until Luke Ryan got on the case. Mm.
So, David, does this go beyond two prosecutors, or is there a larger issue at play here?
Well, this is the Attorney General's office. That's not to say that the judge characterizes the two as the center of it, the heart of it. However, it occurs within the Attorney General's office. When you defend the behavior, when you minimize the damage done, it does damage across the system. So, Maura Healey, it's important that she speak on this issue rather than, in fact, issue no statement and say it's under review. The obligation is on her and Coakley to respond.
All right. So, Luke, I mean, I guess one of the big questions here is who polices the prosecutors to make sure they hand over information to defense attorneys like you?
It's a really important question. It's something that I think courts across the country are struggling with. I mean, David referenced that decision written by the chief judge of the Ninth Circuit back in 2013, and that caused quite a stir. I mean, in his view, he said Brady violations have reached epidemic proportion in recent years. And he went on and he cited about a dozen cases from the state and federal level. And so there's a lot of, I think, proposals that are underway to deal with this problem. In some places, they've proposing open file discovery. But it's a real danger because I said at the outset that there's prosecutors become invested in obtaining convictions in many cases, and it puts them in a position of having a real conflict. And there's a lot of ethical ones out there who do the right thing and give up evidence that hurts their case, but they unfortunately, when they don't do that, it's very difficult to find out.
Well, that's Northampton defense attorney Luke Ryan. Luke, thanks so much for joining us today. We're very grateful to you.
Thanks for having me.
And WBUR senior reporter David Boeri, you can find links to his reporting on all of this at radioboston.org. David, always good to have you. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks, Anthony.
Stay with us. Coming up, we're going to remember Mitchell Chester, Commissioner of Elementary and Secondary Education, who died last night. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.